You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello there and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Tig Enright, and on today's show...
We must also, and above all, now make sure that the countries welcoming refugees outside the European Union, I'm thinking Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, can be helped, because if not, we know very well what might happen. That is to say, this movement, this departure of people from these countries, will come to the European coast, creating dramas that I want to avoid.
The French President François Hollande there at the European Union Leaders Summit in Brussels today. Our guests, Staffan Sonning and Shashank Joshi, will assess if an agreement with Turkey to control the refugee crisis is possible. Then, Iran steps up its role in Syria and deploys troops to support Bashar al-Assad. And in India, more than 40 authors have returned top national awards in protest against what they call a climate of intolerance. Plus, is there any life left in the People's Car brand?
We believe around 2.4 million vehicles are affected in Germany, so a large-scale recall is necessary. Volkswagen will take all steps to keep its customers informed in Cupertino with the KBA.
As Volkswagen is ordered to recall millions of vehicles across Europe, its new boss claims it will get over the scandal in 2 to 3 years. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Tig Enright. So you are very welcome to today's programme of Midori House. My guests are Staffan Sonning, economics correspondent with, I've rehearsed this, Sveriges Radio or Perfect. Swedish Radio.
Perfect.
Almost there. I'm joined also by Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both of you to the programme. Let's get underway. Let's talk about Brussels, or what's happening in Brussels rather, where European leaders have been meeting yet again to discuss the refugee and migrants crisis. And it seems to me, like we've had at least some creative thinking. Angela Merkel proposing that border force officials from all member states could be deployed at the outer limits of the European Union to protect its borders and, I suppose, preserve the Schengen Agreement, the borderlessness that comes with being within the EU or the Schengen area. They're also discussing how to convince Turkey to work in cooperation with the EU to bring the situation under control. Turkey's obviously the bigger question, but I want to just talk and ask you, first of all, Stefan, what you think. How would Sweden like to send border force officials to, say, Greece or Italy?
We could, I guess, but we are already sending rescue personnel, boats and stuff. And I would say if we were to be asked, we would also be willing to send border personnel. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I wonder, would that be held, though, across Europe, particularly certain countries, perhaps Finland, for example, who are a little bit more less enamored with the European project.
Mm. Yeah, the question is of course, what's that supposed to mean? Mm. Are you going to patrol the waters? Are you going to go into Turkish waters? Are you going to stop the dinghies from going further? Are you going to try to pull them back into Turkey? Bit tricky.
Lots to think about, yeah. Yes. Shashank, what do you think of it as a proposal? Is it interesting? Is it radical? Is it more the same?
It is radical. I
mean, there is already an EU border organisation that does some of these things, but not to the point of stationing large numbers of our, you know, personnel from one country to another. And it's a reason for that. It touches at the very core of what a state does. It's a sovereign issue. It's not like coming up with harmonisation of tax on beef exports. And I think, you know, Merkel's ideas are interesting. We obviously are helping to patrol the Mediterranean here in the UK. What I found interesting is how it blurs into some sort of rather crazy ideas as well. For example, Merkel in Germany, they floated the idea of Turkish and Greek Coast Guard vessels patrolling Aegean islands together, which
good
of course...
Good luck with that.
Well, it sounds okay, doesn't it? But of course, if you know anything about the history of Turkey and Greece, their rivalry, the implication of the potential disputes over these islands down the line, it's a complete non-starter.
And indeed,
it's such a sensitive thing.
In Athens, they're worried that Turkey could use it as an example to stake a claim to sort of from islands in the Aegean Sea. It was quite interesting, actually. I mean, earlier in the week, I saw a very powerful news report here in Britain about the journey that many migrants are taking from Turkey to the Greek island of Lesbos. And one of the points the reporter was making was, while there were a handful of Greek Coast Guard vessels in the area, it seemed like there was no effort by the Turks to try and keep people on their side of the border, keeping in mind that what we are talking about here is illegal people trafficking, people smuggling. So, I mean, I suppose that is something for the future, really. But we do have a crisis on our hands, on our shores. And I just, what strikes me from the news coverage I've seen of today's summit is the absence of the old questions of quotas and how to distribute the refugees who are already on our shores, perhaps fairly, sustainably across the EU. Has that disappeared off the agenda altogether?
Well, it's partly because Turkey's not part of that. Turkey's not in the European Union. And this summit was we saw evidence of Turkey almost trying to bargain, saying, look, if you want our help in keeping these people in, we'd like to see something from you as well. And that's something being more visa-free travel into the EU, please.
Indeed.
So this is really sort of a process of bargaining with Ankara as well.
But I mean, everything is gone. I mean, the Dublin Agreement is more less gone. The Schengen agreement is hardly functioning anymore. So, I mean, everybody's sort of milling around here.
You know, reading the coverage today, you might be forgiven for thinking Turkey's kind of been sitting on its hands in this whole situation. But bearing in mind, you know, they've taken in 2.2 million Syrian refugees. I suppose it's hard to know exactly how many of those refugees have then gone on to seek to enter the EU.
And it hasn't given them refugee status, by the way.
Okay. But I wonder how many of those refugees, I suppose it's hard to say, but we have to wonder how many of those refugees from Syria are quite happy to actually sit in the safety, the relative safety of Turkey and not move on to the...
Many are not. And the reason precisely is that Turkey has accorded them a particular status. It doesn't give them the right to seek full employment, full benefits and the full sort of, you know, participation in life, in Turkish life. It's deliberately kept them at a lower status to try and avoid that process of settling in. And that's, of course, one of the reasons why they would much rather be in you know, Munich or Vienna or Stockholm or somewhere else.
And mind you, that the UNHCR, who are supposed to help them, they haven't got enough funding. Mm. They're supposed to have, what is it, $3 a day, and now they got 45 cents.
So one wonders, how far will Brussels, will Berlin, will Paris go to secure the cooperation of Turkey? Are we talking about visa concessions, or are we talking about the bigger question of accelerating, or not so much accelerating, restarting Turkey's journey, if it is that, towards EU membership?
I wouldn't say that.
It's impossible, yeah.
Yeah.
Will they look for it, though?
Yeah.
They could be looking for it in Ankara.
They could look for it, but I mean, they need to look inside first, because you're in an incredibly tumultuous period in Turkish political history. You have major elections coming up in I think a couple of weeks' time, 1st of November or so. You have a party that's increasingly illiberal domestically, increasingly unstable on its northern flank, a peace process breaking down. The prospect of Turkey accelerating membership in the EU right now is zilch.
But it doesn't mean that they couldn't seek some kind of a form of words or a concession, a kind of a promise for the not too distant future, that conversation can start again.
I would say to start with, quite a lot of money to pay Turkey to run their refugee camps.
Okay, let's move on to obviously a not unrelated story, that of Syria itself. And it looks like there could be more to meets the eye when it comes to Russia's recent intervention there, with Iran now reportedly sending hundreds, potentially thousands to follow, of troops to bolster, obviously, their ally in Bashar al-Assad. Now, Iran has, of course, been playing a part in the conflict there for some time with Revolutionary Guard advisors on the ground. But now, according to reports, Shia troops from Tehran, around 2,000, perhaps 5,000 from Lebanon and others, others are reportedly poised to enter Iran for, I suppose, what could be a ground offensive to complement, might or might not be coordinated with Russia's airstrikes. I mean, Shashank, what do you read into these reports?
Well, just to give your listeners a little bit of context, back in July, even before the nuclear deal with Iran was negotiated, Iran sent its top general, Qasem Soleimani, head of the Quds Force of the Revolutionary Guard, to Moscow. And so it's not just a speculation this was coordinated. I think there's mounting evidence Russian intervention was at the urging of Iran and Syria both, and that it was explicitly coordinated with the use of Iranian ground forces in that northwest. It may not be thousands, as some media reports have said, but we have in the past week alone seen three senior Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps generals killed. That's not by chance. You don't just lose three generals on the ground. So clearly, Iran is coordinating with Russia to get Assad some of his northwest territories back as part of strengthening his overall position.
There's another interesting thing. I haven't heard anything about it the last 2 weeks, but a couple of weeks ago, the Chinese were coming in. But since a few weeks back...
Sending some equipment, I think. They're a lot more cautious, obviously, as they always are, but sending some, I think, some vehicles to the Syrian armed forces.
There were rumors about the only Chinese aircraft carrier being in Syria.
It can't even sail out of port at the moment. So.
Not obviously boding well for the West's friends in Syria, the opposition forces that we're hearing, the opposition to them being bolstered potentially by these Iranian troops. But explain for us, Shashank, if you will. I mean, as you say, Iran's been in Syria for some time. It's lost senior generals in recent times. We understand Russia's strategic interest in Syria, given the deep water port that's there. Why is it, apart from the fact that they have been long-standing allies, what's the strategic interest in Tehran in sticking its neck out on this?
The single biggest one is undoubtedly the fact that Syria is valuable not just for itself, but because it's a staging point and conduit to Iran's biggest regional allies, the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah, which is the very powerful group that effectively control Lebanon. Iran cannot supply Hezbollah with the kind of long-range, sophisticated missiles it supplies, unless it has access to things like Damascus Airport and then the overland route into Lebanon. And that's why we have seen its military efforts focused along the Lebanese border, where Hezbollah has been fighting in large numbers. And we've seen things in the past month like Iran negotiating a truce directly with a Sunni fundamentalist group, Ahrar al-Sham, negotiating it with the Turks, saying, look, get the Sunnis out of this area, let's make it Shia, and then we can use it to continue supporting Hezbollah. So amongst their many interests, I would say Hezbollah is in big flashing lights at the top of that list.
Very good. I mean, it's quite obviously a boost for Assad, a balance tipper, you would think. I mean, if the West does nothing more, I mean, in the last few days we heard, the United States no longer going to be training up its own rebel force within Syria.
The CIA will, the Pentagon won't. But critical distinction.
seeking to arm the established opposition forces, promising to screen them to make sure that they are who they say they are and they're ambitions are what they say they are. It does beg the question if the West's plan for Syria really has any legs left in it at all.
What plan?
What plan indeed? Question. Could we ultimately, I mean, where are we going? Where is we going to end up if Iran is sending troops, Russia is stepping up airstrikes?
The old Chinese.
And perhaps the Chinese. Are we seeing the West is not geared up for a kind of a proxy war with Russia in Syria, is it? And is the West going to continue sitting on its relative hands, shall we say?
We're not going to intervene, that's for sure. But I would say, first of all, just because the Pentagon has stopped sending weapons and training up rebels, there is still a massive covert intelligence-led effort that's reaped a lot of fruit, particularly in the realm of anti-tank weapons. They've been very, very effective on the ground. They may even have been one of the reasons why Russia had to send forces to stop the bleeding.
Is it fair to assess that the West has not been doing as much as it should?
Well, it's not for me to say what it should or shouldn't do. If you believe that they should have established a no-fly zone years ago, seriously built up the opposition in order to make good on their commitment that Assad must go, absolutely. But I do think we should also avoid falling into the trap of thinking they've sat on their hands. And I think the other important thing to do is to remember is the Gulf states here, our allies, Saudi Arabia, Qatar and Turkey, have done an enormous amount with our help. There's a joint operations room in southern Turkey in the town of Rehanli, where you'll find offices of MI6, the CIA, and the Turks all getting together and allocating arms, cash, ammunition to rebels. We don't read about this because it's obviously a covert program and it's not discussed very widely. But we haven't been doing nothing, I would say. That's all. It may still be incoherent, but it's still there.
Okay. There we will have to leave that discussion. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tadhg Enright. I'm joined by Staffan Sonning and by Shashank Joshi. Coming up next, Indian authors are giving back their awards and Volkswagen is recalling more than 8 million vehicles in Europe, but claiming it'll get over this scandal within 2 to 3 years. Do stay with us.
It's out. The new November issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, and it delivers a dynamic lineup of reports from around the globe and a special focus on the world of design. Here's what our editors have found for you this month.
In the design section, we head to an under-the-radar town in southern Spain and meet the secretive producers making leatherware for Europe's best brands.
In the edit section, we're directed to a Franconia restaurant in Berlin for filmmaker Wim Wenders' last meal.
Our November issue also includes our special Bavaria survey and a visit to a unique brewery where you can feel the Forscht. Get your copy today.
Each week on The Foreign Desk, we take a look at a single story, we find two or three great guests, and then we try to work out what's going on. It might be the story that's dominating the news that week.
The main thing they wanted to do was to stop to get rid of Obama. How are you going to negotiate with that?
It might be something we think everyone else is ignoring.
Children, elderly, it doesn't matter. Anybody that is leaving the country is going to be shot.
Either way, the format's the same. Guests who know their stuff, talking knowledgeably, so that you and me end up knowing a little bit more than we did before. That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time and available at any time on monocle.com.
And you're very welcome back to Midori House here in Monocle 24 with me, Tadhg Enright. Still with me in the studio, Staffan Sonning and Shashank Joshi. Welcome both of you back to the programme. Let's head to India now, where 41 authors have decided to give back big, prestigious national awards that they received. This in protest against what they describe as a climate of intolerance. It all follows a series of incidents, violent attacks on intellectuals since the BJP party, the Hindu Nationalist Party, won power in last year's elections. They're claiming, these authors, that there's been a big surge in violence from extremist Hindus against their enemies since the election of Narendra Modi, and that the authorities are turning a blind eye. Shashank, is there any merit in what they're saying?
There certainly is. I mean, this has gone on for a long time. It's not just under this government. But what is clear is that this government, its right-wing allies, not necessarily the government itself, but those who sort of are in the same ideological camp and more extreme, there's a group called the RSS, have been emboldened. You have a culture minister in India, for example, who says things like, we must purge the polluting culture of the West from India, who called the lynching of a Muslim labourer for allegedly eating beef a misunderstanding that shouldn't be politicised. The Prime Minister didn't say anything in condemnation of that murder. So it's relatively small things in isolation, but they add up to a widespread and I think justifiable sense that this government is at best sort of too relaxed about the creeping communalization, as the Indians call it, of religious sentiment, sharpening hostility, and at worst, inciting it.
I covered the election 2014 when Modi won by a landslide, and there were warning words from people saying that he might have a bit of a problem handling the Hindu nationalism. And I think that might be what we are seeing now. He has.
Just put into context for us, Shashank, if you will, for those who are not intimately familiar, I suppose, with the dynamics and the context behind this. You know, who are these extremists? What are their objectives?
Well, India, when it became independent, was established as a secular, liberal, constitutional democracy with equal rights for all religions. But many Hindus didn't like that. They thought, look, Pakistan's created as a Muslim-majority state. India is a majority Hindu country. We'd like to see everyone respect that. So, you know, if you want to eat beef, go get out of India. If you want to disrespect Hindu gods, get out of India. We don't care about your liberal rights and your equal respect for all traditions. Please leave. And what you saw over 60, 70 years is that movement become overly politicized and eventually take shape as the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP. And it has a very extreme wing called the RSS. You know, these people sort of dress up in little Boy Scout-like uniforms and march up and down drill rounds. But their more wild wings will intimidate Muslims. You see particular upswells of this during local elections. And here's the key to this. There's a huge election occurring very shortly in a big, big northern state of Bihar. And what you always see in these things is these right-wing groups rile up sentiment in the hope of provoking more Hindus to vote for them. So it's not just about the Hindu nationalists at the top in Delhi. It's very local things driving it as well. Elections always create these swells of intolerance and bigotry.
Talking of elections, Stefan, and you said you were there for the last elections. Did you hear, see any echoes of this or hints of what could be to come during the campaign?
No, not then, because he was sort of the guy who was going to bring the salvation to India. Almost everything at that time was about the economy and what he had done as a local leader, and the hopes that he would try to sort of transform India in the same way. So it was a bit of a talk about it, but the big discussion, no, it was about economy.
But he had, of course, to give listeners a little bit of more context too, Modi himself had been governor of Gujarat, chief minister of Gujarat, where he himself had been widely seen as complicit, maybe even encouraging major pogroms against Muslims that took place back in 2002. And that's why, of course, he was denied a visa to the United States for many years. He was a pariah in India. Other foreign ambassadors wouldn't meet him in Delhi. So, you know, he himself has now distanced himself from some of the more nasty stuff. The problem is the people around him and his ideological fellow travellers.
Right, let's talk about the protest at hand. We're talking about it. Is it being widely discussed in India too?
It certainly is. There's an upswell of anger from the artistic community, because it's not just about attacks on local labourers or local village attacks. There's also a higher level thing that directly affects those who paint, those who write. Last year, for example, we saw a publisher in India forced to pulp or withdraw books by Wendy Doniger, an American academic who had written on Hinduism. Before that, of course, there's a history of this. We'd seen Salman Rushdie's book, The Satanic Verses, first banned in India before it became famous for being banned and attacked in Iran, even. So it's being reported, and I think there's real concern as to where this goes next. Are we going to see new curbs on speech? Are we going to see newspapers leaned on? Are we going to see books withdrawn? That all may be a little extreme, but it's the sense of creeping restraint that worries so many in Delhi.
Okay. There we'll leave that topic and move on to Volkswagen, the story of the moment, arguably, the industrial story, business story of the moment. Today we heard that they're going to have to recall more than 8 million cars in Europe. This obviously all arising from the recent emissions scandal. But the company's new boss, Matthias Müller, has been speaking and pretty confidently predicted that he thinks it will bounce back within 2 to 3 years. All the while, the head of VW in North America has resigned. Goodness, who knew it would take so long? Analysts estimating that the £4.8 billion that the company has put aside to cover the costs of this scandal won't be enough to cover the actual final costs. I think there's very little surprise in that either. Stefan, Matthias Müller, confident that VW can bounce back in a couple of years. That's a bit optimistic, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it depends on what do they mean with solving the problem. They have got this software trick, fixing
the software to cheat the testing equipment with a factor of 40. Yeah.
If you fix that, even in natural conditions, you reduce the emissions with a factor 40. How will your car behave after that? It has not been answered. So the question is, of course, what do they mean by fixing this problem? And that is, of course, the basis for the answer. Can it be fixed in 2, 3, or 4 years?
And the key thing in all this, and the thing that separates it from the scandal or the recall, the big recall we had involving Toyota a few years ago. Toyota, if I'm not wrong, is actually the world's biggest car maker. VW is number two. Toyota always had a great reputation for reliability, for quality. So too does VW. Toyota had to recall around 10 million cars a few years ago because of a problem with acceleration that they were seen not to have done something about very quickly. But this was cheating. This was VW setting out there to cheat. And how does a brand bounce back from that?
I think there's two other differences too. One of them is, I don't recall how badly Toyota was hit financially, but a quarter of Volkswagen's stock market value has been wiped out. I don't think Toyota was quite as bad as that. And secondly, related to the reason you suggest, this will have knock-on effects on the regulatory regime in Europe and elsewhere. We are already seeing the German environment minister suggest, for example, that there should be withdrawn the subsidy for diesel cars and more promotion of electric cars. So it will change the environment in which Volkswagen has to compete itself. And that will have long-term effects that might not otherwise have occurred.
One of the other things Matthias Müller said as a way of getting over this scandal is he wants to give more power to his brands. And I suppose one of the things that people who don't follow business news or aren't big up on cars, they might not realise that, of course, VW also owns Audi, Seat, Skoda, Porsche. And is he hoping that VW is the only name that will actually be tarnished and he can kind of invest more in these brands which are VWs in disguise?
Difficult to say, of course, but I mean, already, like cars like brands like Seat have admitted that they got the same problem. So
it's the same. I mean, that's one of the bases of that company, that you have essentially the same car platform, which is dressed up differently and put a different badge on it, and you sell it at different prices, at different specs to different buyers.
Maybe not Porsche.
that's one unto itself. And
yeah.
We've heard the police in Italy have raided Volkswagen offices in Bologna, and it smacks me as a little bit of showboating, doesn't it? Because we know what they've done. They've admitted to it. I mean, do the police in Italy think that they're going to find something that we don't know about already, you have to wonder?
The smoking engine.
Yeah. And is it just picking up, Shashank, on what you'd said earlier there, some reports VW could actually abandon diesels altogether and instead start trying to focus on petrols, hybrids and electric cars as a way out of this. But it just strikes me, it's not so much that diesel technology itself has been tarnished by all this. It's more that the VW brand simply has, you know, this kind of heavyweight juggernaut of German industry, and, you know, they've been on the fiddle.
Absolutely. And that's why I'm skeptical of the idea of like a bank consolidates bad loans into a bad bank. Volkswagen is the overarching label. I'm not sure you can just push the cancer into one limb and hack it off. I don't think there are many other cases where the overarching linchpin of an entire network of brands is the one that's been tarnished. I think it'll be extremely difficult to overcome that.
Although it might be a good idea to go, good time to go out and buy a VW on the cheap, perhaps. Some of us might be looking into that. There we will have to leave the programme. Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute and Staffan Sonning from Swedish Radio, Sveriges Radio. Thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's edition of the programme. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Antonio Mertzhäuser, and our studio manager was Chris Grimes. For the next half hour, Chris Chilvers Silvers. We'll be keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist. At 1900 hours London time, that's the top of the hour, it's The Urbanist with Tom Edwards. And at 2200 tonight, that's in 4 or 5.5 hours time, it's time for the Monocle Daily. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow, that's 1800 hours London time. But from this edition of Midori House and from me, Tighe Enright, it's goodbye and thank you very much for listening.